Good evening, and welcome to tonight's program hosted by the Commonwealth Club Silicon Valley and by Wonderfest. My name is Tucker Hyatt, founding director of Wonderfest. It is my pleasure to introduce Dr. Leonard Mlodinow, author of The Upright Thinkers, The Human Journey from Living in Trees to Understanding the Cosmos. Dr. Mlodinow graduated with a master's degree in physics from Brandeis University and a doctorate in theoretical physics from the University of California at Berkeley. He was an Alexander von Humboldt Fellow at the Max Planck Institute in Germany, in Munich, Germany, and he was a Bantrell Research Fellow in theoretical physics at Caltech. Dr. Mlodinow's interest in popular science led him to Hollywood, where he wrote for three television series, Star Trek: The Next Generation, MacGyver, and Night Court. He later shifted to computer gaming and worked with Steven Spielberg, Robin Williams, and the Walt Disney Company to design and produce award-winning games. He then joined Scholastic Incorporated, where he was head of software and where he created one of the top five children's games divisions in the U.S. Dr. Mlodinow has written five best-selling books, including two co-authored with Stephen Hawking, the number one New York Times bestseller, The Grand Design, and the international bestseller, A Briefer History of Time. Dr. Mlodinow's book, Subliminal, How Your Unconscious Mind Rules Your Behavior, won the 2013 Penn E.O. Wilson Award for Literary Science Writing. And his 2008, The Drunkard's Walk, was a New York Times bestseller. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the man Stephen Hawking says, and I quote, never fails to make science both accessible and entertaining, Dr. Leonard Mlodinow.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming. So we're going to talk about the human journey today, from living in trees to understanding the universe. In my book, I structure the book chronologically. So I divided time into different eras. The first eras take millions of years, and then they take thousands of years. The next one takes hundreds of years, and then it's just decades, because the pace of our acquiring new knowledge is ever accelerating, because the amount of knowledge that we acquire is proportional both to the population and to the amount of knowledge that exists at any time. And so it's going ever faster. We started out about 4 million years ago as a human species, but not Homo sapiens. There were other humans before us, and there were many different species of humans throughout history. Homo is the term for human, and it's a genus, which is a group of species. We are Homo sapiens sapiens, which is a subspecies of Homo sapiens. So there's been a lot of evolution of humans throughout the millennia and millions of years. And all the other species of humans before us died off and became extinct. And in fact, we even almost became extinct about 150,000 years ago. Our numbers dwindled to just a few hundred. And we were an endangered species, but fortunately we survived. And scientists think that the reason we survived is not our brute intelligence, and it's certainly not our physical attributes. We're not very strong compared to other primates. Our teeth aren't really that sharp or powerful. We're not very fast. But what we are good at, and this may surprise you, depending on what social circles you travel in, is social interaction. When we were an immature species, our brains were like other primates, and then at some point they grew. And scientists today believe that our brains didn't grow to allow us to do physics and mathematics that we like to do today, or literature or poetry, but to allow social interaction. So when you look at another person, you don't just identify a person, but you can tell what that person is thinking and feeling. And you can tell what that person is thinking that you're thinking. And you can tell what that person is thinking you think that they're thinking. And they can tell what you think, they think, you're thinking that, I can't say it anymore, I get lost. But actually, psychologists say that we can go 6 degrees into this, and that's very useful for calculating what's going on for creating large social units and cooperation. And we did this, we used this cooperation to collectively find food and protect ourselves from predators and get shelter, and that's how we survived. At about 10,000 B.C., another great transformation occurred in the way we live. So until then, people lived in the wild and they were foragers, and they followed the food and they followed the water and they moved around depending on the climate. And around that time came what is called the Neolithic Revolution or the Agricultural Revolution. So you may have learned about that in school. It was a time when people settled into villages, they stayed in place, and they domesticated animals and they grew crops. And they told me in school when I studied it that we did that because we can grow food more efficiently that way and we had a better life. And that's actually totally wrong. Studying the remains of nomads and the remains of the early farmers, scientists have realized that the nomads were better nourished. It took in more calories, a greater variety of food, had fewer vitamin deficiencies, lived longer, and had a better life than the farmers who followed them. So the question is, why did we settle down? And one very interesting answer is starting to emerge, which is that we settled down because our bigger brains started us asking questions about the world around us, and we started to develop spirituality. And around the time we settled down, around 10,000 BC, is also the time that scientists have discovered the first temples. And in addition, when we look at the villages that date back to that period, there's a striking difference between the life of those people and the nomads, which is that the people who lived in those settlements kept their dead with them. So nomads, when someone got old and sick, they would leave them behind and they would keep going. And the person would die and just rot in the field or on the side of the hill like any other animal. And at some point, people started to wonder about what happens after we die and to think that it's good to keep the dead with us for spiritual reasons. And in order to do that, people had to settle down, and the people in the early villages actually kept their ancestors, so to speak, under the floorboards. They lived, they built right on top of them, and they made holes, and they dug underneath their dwellings and buried their dead there. So this kind of questioning about our place in the world and what it's all about and where we go when we die drove the humans to settle down. But they weren't, at first they didn't settle into what we would call cities, because even though some of these settlements had thousands of people, each family was self-sufficient. And it's very hard to find a reason for the settlement other than these spiritual issues. And after some thousands of years, though, another change occurred, which is that we started to differentiate our labor. So we had division of labor, and certain people now would be butchers, certain people would be bakers and candlestick makers, and there was a specialization. So we no longer needed each family to be self-sufficient, but now we had professions. And that caused another great intellectual revolution, because once we had professions and a division of labor, we needed to keep records. We needed to keep records of goods and of services, of who owes whom money. We had to start having taxes and keep records of taxation. And so writing was invented and arithmetic. And that was a huge step for humankind. Language is something that comes naturally to us. There's genes in our brain that control that, and we have a special capacity for language. And every tribe that has ever been discovered throughout history has always had spoken language, but not written language. And we believe that written language only emerged two or three times in human history, and that all languages that we have today are derivatives of those initial languages. So it's a very difficult invention, but it was done for a very practical purpose, which was to keep records. So the first writing was simply lists of goods and lists of things that were owed to different people, kind of like accounting. And the first intellectual classes that arose then were people who studied this and taught other people how to do it. So the first, so to speak, professors were professors of reading, writing, and arithmetic. And that happened in Mesopotamia around 3000 BC. And then it took another 1,000 or 2,000 years. And then the Greeks had this other revolutionary idea, which is that we can use reason to understand the world, and we don't have to believe that everything comes through the will of gods. And that started with people like Thales and Pythagoras around 600, 700 BC. And it really reached a high point with a fellow named Aristotle. And Aristotle was, in a way, the epitome of the scientist. He was a very powerful empiricist who worked very hard and studied all sorts of phenomena in nature, from dissecting animals and looking in their stomachs to see what's in there, to studying geology and climate. And he basically wrote about almost every science that we have today. And he had, in some ways, extraordinary insight, but the problem, I call him a one-man Wikipedia based on all his writings, but the one problem that we have with Aristotle is that he was almost completely wrong about everything. Now, one of the reasons that he was wrong was that he had a preconceived notion that he got by observing the world, which was that things seem to happen for a purpose. So when he investigated all these different sciences, he was always looking for the purpose, and he was always looking, creating theories of how things happened to get toward a certain end. And he wasn't very interested in quantitative prediction, in measuring anything, and it was hard to measure back then. We didn't have clocks like we do today. No one thought of time as being divided into seconds and minutes. And so it was a difficult technologically, but it was also a different way of thinking. People thought very qualitatively. And so his theories tended to have to do with things reaching their natural state or changing because of a purpose. And so the next step was to liberate ourselves from that and to look at quantitative science that describes what happens but doesn't focus on things happening for a reason. And that's what we call the scientific revolution that happened around 1300 to 1700. Now, it's called the scientific revolution, but like the agricultural revolution, it's really a misnomer. It really wasn't, first of all, a revolution in the way we normally think of a revolution. It took 400 years. And so a revolution you think of as a sudden upheaval and overthrowing something, and this was a very gradual, and it was done in fits and starts, and it wasn't done by a united group of people striving for a common goal. It was just done by a motley assortment of different people, each studying something of their own interest. And finally, the final era that I talk about is the era of the 20th century, that started around 1900, which is appropriate if it's the 20th century. And it was very different from all prior science in that now scientists started to look at things that they couldn't sense with their unaided senses or they couldn't measure with their unaided senses, things that you can't see and feel and hear. What happened was that technology reached a certain point where we could detect things with technology that were undetectable through our senses. Prior to that, of course, people used microscopes and telescopes to aid the senses, but you were still seeing the phenomena that you were analyzing with your eyes. But around 1900, we started to find things like, for instance, electrons that we couldn't see, but which would cause results that we could detect indirectly. For instance, if an electron impinges on a phosphorescent screen, it makes a little flash, so you can see an electron indirectly that way. Or X-rays are given off by certain elements, and they can be detected on photographic film that we can see. And it got more and more complex, and what scientists realized was that there's a whole hidden world out there that is beyond our human experience and that we have to describe using concepts that are completely foreign to us in everyday life. And they also discovered that there were laws governing these things that were foreign to us in our everyday life, and that Newton described our perceived world very well, but it didn't work for this world. And so that was another revolution, the science of things that are beyond our experience. So that's a brief rundown of the timeline of scientific development that I talk about. But the point of my book isn't that. The point of my book is something else. This is a picture of my father sitting with my mother the night he proposed to her. That's so cute, yeah. And that's at the Tavern on the Green in New York. And he's making a toast here. And they're both Holocaust survivors. And my father in particular was in the underground, the anti-Nazi underground, and eventually in a concentration camp. And so he saw the really the very worst of humanity. And he also saw some of the best of humanity and some of the heroic deeds that his comrades performed, not all of them surviving. And he had only a seventh grade education. And ironically, when I hit around seventh or eighth grade, he got interested in what I was learning, and I was very interested in science. And he wasn't interested very much in the laws of science or the technical matters of science, but in what science told us about people and the human condition and how people practice science, and also what the fact that people do science tells us about the human nature itself. So I always thought I would write a book explaining all this to him, and this is that book. Now, he died about 25 years ago, so I'm a little late with it, but better late than never, and so the book is dedicated to him. In school, we learned the scientific method, that we, if we're curious by nature, we study nature, we come up with a question that we want to answer, we form a hypothesis, and we figure out an experiment to test that hypothesis, to test the implications of that hypothesis. The experiment can also be an observation. If you're an astrophysicist, you can't build a star in your lab, but you can make predictions about stars and then observe them. So it's an experiment or some observations, and then we analyze the results, we draw a conclusion, and we either modify our hypothesis or throw it out, form another hypothesis, or we say we found support for the hypothesis, and we keep looking. And a good scientist is always trying to falsify the hypothesis and poke holes in it, and the more experiments that the hypothesis survives, the more confidence we have in it. So not long ago, my daughter, who's 14, a freshman in high school, came up to me excitedly and said, Daddy, we learned the scientific method, and we learned all about Darwin and how that works, with evolution. And this is a picture, this is on the screen right now, is a slide showing her textbook. It says evidence for evolution in Darwin's time, and it says that he found evidence from a variety of sources. And in particular, it highlights the finches of the Galapagos Islands. These finches on different islands had different shaped beaks, which were adapted to the environment on that island, that the seeds and that they had to break to eat. And the habitat on the different islands differed, and so did the finches. And Darwin, this book tells us, explained that by saying that the birds varied through random mutation, and that when they had a mutation that was more favorable to surviving on that island, then that species was altered in that manner, and so the species grew apart on the different islands. And if you look on the internet, you'll see a lot of websites that talk about that. The BBC, for instance, which I show here, talks about the same story about how Darwin went to the Galapagos Islands and found evidence or proof for his theory of evolution. So that looks like a very neat example of the scientific method at work, and the only problem with it is that it's completely wrong. It didn't happen that way at all. First of all, Darwin was a lousy ornithologist. So when he found finches and collected the specimens of finches, he labeled them grosbeaks and blackbirds and various things, but often not as finches. Also, he didn't realize the significance of the finches that he found, so he didn't mark them according to what island they came from. And so this whole analysis that we're talking about could not possibly have happened. So let me tell you a story, just as an example of what I talk about in my book, of the real Darwin story. I call it Darwin's Barnacles, the real Darwin story. You'll see why I called it Darwin's Barnacles in a minute. So like the good scientists of the textbooks, Darwin started out by asking a question. The question that he went on his voyage with was this: what should I do with my life? It's a good question for all scientists and for the rest of us too. So he was wondering about that because, you know, Darwin was a religious man, a man of Christian faith, although I think his father must have been Jewish because his father tried to push him into becoming a doctor. And he did go to medical school. And he found, you know, that he was too queasy. He couldn't take it. And in those days, when they did operations, first of all, there was no anesthetic, so the patients could be screaming in pain, and there was blood splattering everywhere. And Darwin really didn't have the fortitude for that, and so he quit medical school. So then he was thinking, what should I do? And his father now said, well, maybe become a clergyman. And that's a respectable profession. And Darwin thought that he would become a clergyman, but he also had an intuition that maybe that was too quiet a life for him. And so then along came this invitation to go on the Beagle and take a cruise. Now, we talk about him as if he was a ship's naturalist, and that indeed was the title of the job that he had. But that's really only a small part of the story. So these ships were run by captains who were of a social class that was higher than that of the crew. And because of that, in those days, they were not allowed to socialize with anyone on the crew. So the ship would go for 4 or 5 years on these voyages, and the captain wouldn't be able to talk to anybody or eat with anybody and have to be totally alone. So this has a bad effect on people. I talked about how we're a social species. Well, the last captain of the Beagle felt so bad about this isolation that he killed himself. So now the Beagle's going on another trip, and the guy who's the captain of this one was the second in command last time. And he says, well, wait a minute. What can I do about this? I don't want to have the same fate. And so he was looking for someone of a high social class to be the naturalist, to be essentially his paid companion. And that he offered that to somebody who turned it down. And the second choice was Darwin, and Darwin agreed to do it. But it wasn't about evolution. What Darwin thought he was going to do on the trip had nothing to do with biology at all, for the most part. He was interested in geology. So even though he was a ship's naturalist, he knew he'd have a lot of opportunity to observe geological formations, and that's what he really was interested in doing on the trip. And here's an excerpt from a letter he wrote. Geology and the invertebrate animals will be my chief object of pursuit throughout the whole voyage. And then I have an excerpt of something he wrote at the end of the trip, and it does it say, ooh, I went to study some invertebrates in geology, but I discovered evolution, and I'm going to be famous, and I revolutionized everything, and those great finches, we had a good time. No, he said, during this cruise, I've done little except in geology. So this was his own assessment of what he had done. And indeed, when he got back to England, he got pretty famous in the circles that did geology, and he was given a lot of invitations to speak because he made a lot of very good observations about geology, but not about biology. But what he did do was collect specimens along the way and send them back for people to study. And in fact, the position he had as a ship's naturalist was an unpaid position. When I was writing in Hollywood, we would call that writing on spec. He was a naturalist on spec. He would send his samples back, and if people liked them, they would pay him for it. And he started to get letters from people who were analyzing the specimens that he collected, and that started him thinking about evolution. Now, he wasn't by no means the first person to think about evolution. His grandfather had written about evolution. A lot of people had written about evolution, but not in the way that he eventually did. And the difference is that just to say that species are changing is an unsupported speculation, and it's really no more informative than the story in the Bible. It's just your opinion. But what Darwin did was he figured out a mechanism for evolution through random variation and natural selection, and he found reams and reams of evidence to support his position. So that's what made Darwin great, not just the idea that perhaps species evolved. Just to show you as an example of what he did, what I'm showing you now is the front page of a book that he wrote, which was just one of many byproducts of his years of work on evolution to develop his ideas. This is a 658-page book on the exciting topic of different species of barnacles. So he studied barnacles deeply enough to write a 658-page book on them, and he studied many other species as well. And to give you a graphic example of how he changed an effort and over how many years he had to work on evolution, what I'm showing you now is a picture of a very handsome young Darwin with rosy cheeks and looking pretty happy. That's what he looked like at the beginning of his work on evolution. And this old, cranky old guy is what he looked like at the end of his theory when he figured out evolution. So it took its toll. What are a few things that he was up to? Well, he studied the animals in the London Zoo. That was a great resource for him. He fed birds seeds, and he studied their poop. Why would he do that? Well, in figuring out how evolution was working, he was looking at the spread of different species, and he was looking at how plants can spread from the mainland to islands or between different islands. And one way of doing that is to get spread by birds, either in their feathers or maybe they ate the seeds. And that was his speculation. And he wanted to know how long the seeds could survive inside a bird before it pooped it out, and whether the seeds, when they came out, would be viable. He also examined the work of horse breeders, dog breeders, and pigeon breeders who used artificial selection to create new breeds. And despite his queasiness and his squeamishness, he dissected hundreds of animals to compare their anatomy. He was actually a very determined person. There's a story of when he was a kid and he was interested in beetles for a while, and he was out in the field and he caught a beetle in his left hand and he looked at it, and another kind of beetle ran and he caught it with his right hand, and he was looking at the differences, and then another beetle ran by and he only had two hands. So what did the young Darwin do? He popped one of the beetles in his mouth and caught the third beetle. So he was not a guy that was easily stopped when he had an idea that he wanted to pursue. He also studied the emotions of primates and their facial expressions when they were experiencing emotions, and compared them to people. And he studied the emotions and the facial expressions of people from different cultures to see if they were universal. And these studies are things that neuroscientists still refer to today. And of course, he studied barnacles, and he did a lot of other work in the years that he worked on evolution. So far from being an epiphany he had by seeing a few finches on islands, this was a extremely well-documented and thought-out and hard come by hard work theory. And his true timeline is this. He spent 5 years on the voyage, 1831 to 1836. He was a creationist when he began the voyage, and he was a creationist when he finished the voyage. The next year, he finally started developing his theory when the reports of the people who were examining his specimens were coming in. 5 years later, it took him 5 years to complete just a 35-page synopsis of his ideas. That's even slower than me. That's 7 pages a year. And he was still a creationist at that point, but he had to modify now his creationism. So a strict creationist, if you go to Kansas and talk to somebody, they'll say that God put certain species on the earth, and they're unchanging. The species we see today are the same species that were always there. And Darwin knew that this wasn't true, but he still had faith in God, and so he modified his creationism to be slightly different. He believed that God put certain species on the earth in certain habitats with the design that they would evolve in those habitats according to his plan, and that this evolution that he's looking at is just God's plan for the change of species through time. And though his faith in Christianity did erode somewhat during the years, it wasn't evolution that destroyed it. It was something else. It was when his 10-year-old daughter Annie died in 1851. And that he couldn't accept, and that finally turned him against religion and made him into an atheist. And finally, in 1858, about 20-some years after he started, he announced his theory, his completed theory of evolution. Now, I'm taking a brief detour from talking about how science was done, and just want to talk about how destructive these myths that simplify science can be. What they do is they make people think that science is not as complex and rich as it really is, and that anyone who has an epiphany by looking at some simple situation in the world can therefore come up with a law that is going to be taken as valid in science and revolutionize the world, or is as valid as the laws that scientists come up with. This is very common in the media today. I wrote a couple books with Stephen Hawking, and I can say that he did not sit in front of a fireplace and look at some embers and come up with Hawking radiation. That took a lot of hard work over many months and a lot of sweat, and it wasn't just the product of a simple idea that he had when he was looking into a fire. And even if your initial impetus is something like that, your ideas have to be a lot deeper and a lot more complex to make any impact in science. And when we have issues of scientific nature that come up in politics today, and it's unfortunate people have this oversimplified vision of what science is. And one of the issues that's in the news today is autism and vaccines. And this slide represents one of the early papers on that. In this paper, they studied 498 cases of autism. They did a detailed study, and they did a detailed statistical analysis, and they found that there's no evidence whatsoever of a connection between vaccines and the onset of autism. And in the years after this paper was published, over 2,000 researchers referred to it in further articles, which not only tells you that people are scrutinizing this work, but it tells you that there's thousands of people working on this subject. And we shouldn't dismiss their work lightly. And now what this slide shows is how people do that. This is Senator Rand Paul saying, "I've heard of many tragic cases of walking, talking, normal children who wound up with profound mental disorders after vaccines." So if Darwin can be in the Galapagos and see some finches and come up with evolution, I guess Rand Paul can look at some sad cases of kids who have troubles and connect them with vaccines. But the truth is, it just doesn't work that way. So I hope that I've given you some little taste in my short talk tonight of how we really do science, that it's far more complicated than the myths portray, and that most pioneer geniuses experience failure after failure after failure before they get success. And it was not only Darwin coming up with wrong dead ends in his thinking about evolution, but this happens, you know, like Newton, for instance, who did not see an apple fall and come up with his laws of motion while he sat on his farm. That came decades later and after much more work and much more thought. And this is true in most scientific discoveries. Even the ones that appear to have come in a sudden epiphany really only came after a lot of dead ends and hard work. And unfortunately, when we go down those dead ends, we don't always know we're going there, and we can waste a lot of time. And the truth is that scientists are often confused about their theories right up until the moment that they complete them, and they're often confused about their theories even after they complete them. And if I had more time, I could give you examples of that, but if you read the book, it's full of it. Also, most ideas that scientists have prove wrong. And again, unfortunately, we don't always know within a day or a week or a month that they're wrong. Sometimes we work years on the wrong ideas, but then we have to accept that they're wrong. And that's fine, because that's how science is done. And anyone who's afraid to have a wrong idea will probably never have a right idea either. And so finally, the lesson is that through science history, curiosity, stubbornness, and what psychologists call grit have proven more important than insight. Now, grit is this ability to keep going, even though there are barriers and daunting problems ahead of you, to keep going without giving up. And psychologists of the last decade or so have been studying this in great detail and found that not just in science, but in all areas, from the military to marriages, grit is the key to success. So before I conclude, I want to just show you that of all the triumphs of science over the millennia and the centuries and these last decades, I think the most important is that it's increased life expectancy. This graph shows you that leading up to the 19th century, people generally lived between 35 and 40 years old. And around 1800, the fruits of new science started feeding into the Industrial Revolution and resulted in a lot of invention of new chemicals, new medicines, new machines to make life easier and new ways of making people healthier. And there's been a steady climb in life expectancy ever since. And let's hope that keeps up and that we listen to science and on issues like global warming and vaccines and don't turn things around. Let me close with two quotes. The first is from Albert Einstein. And he said, "The most beautiful and deepest experience a man can have is the sense of the mysterious." And the next one is from Tom Stoppard, a playwright, who also talks about the soul of the scientist and states it a little more eloquently even. And he says, "For a scientist, it's the best possible time to be around, to be alive, when almost everything you thought you knew is wrong." Thank you.
First of all, my name is Jason Jigu. Thundering voice comes in. I'll be your moderator for tonight. So, just to start off, did you have a big party in the physics community when they discovered the Higgs boson?
There were a lot of parties, yeah, and it's interesting because the LHC was built to see the Higgs boson, but of course, since the theory predicted it, everyone expected that it would be found. Yeah. And in a sense, it wasn't as big a triumph as it would have been if it were something surprising. And yet, some people, like Stephen Hawking, for instance, predicted maybe through wishful thinking that we wouldn't find it, but we did. And it's just another triumph for something called the Standard Model, which describes all the elementary particles of nature and the different forces. And it's really the most successful theory in history of science.
But it's opened up more questions than answers now. It's a bit of a conundrum about what model is really going to take place now?
No. I mean, actually, it's the opposite. So we have, there's four forces of nature, gravity, and then there's two nuclear forces called the strong and the weak force, and then there's electromagnetic force, which we used to think were two different forces until the 19th century, electricity and magnetism. But electromagnetic force, the strong and the weak force, are all described by this quantum theory called the Standard Model. And when I give the longer talk, I actually show you the equations of the Standard Model. They take two pages in fine print. So it's a very complex and, to a physicist, a very dirty set of equations. It has a lot of parameters that you have to enter in, for instance, that the theory doesn't explain, but that you have to discover experimentally, like the charge of the electron, the masses of quarks, and things like that. And so it's a pretty ugly-looking theory. And that's the conundrum, because it works really well and we haven't really found any problems with it, which physicists would love to do, so that they have a hint as to what might be a better, more elegant theory to take its place. Now, just to cap that off, I did mention gravity, and there's a whole separate theory of gravity, which is due to Einstein, called general relativity, and we don't yet have a way of integrating that as a quantum theory with the theory of those other three forces.
So they talked about, you know, having great evolutions in science and great leaps through your entire timeline. And even Hawkins theorized that we would have the theory of everything by the turn of the century. Are we close to that, or is there such a beast?
Stephen said that in the 80s. So he said that by the end of the century, we'd have a theory of everything. And so I asked him, it was around 2005, I said, what do you have to say about that prediction now? And he said, I still think that by the end of the century, we'll have a theory of everything. So he's good at weaseling out of things. I don't know when we'll... another fellow I knew when I was a young scientist at Caltech was Richard Feynman, who was an iconic physicist. And I wrote a book about my interactions with him called Feynman's Rainbow. He was a big influence on me and a big influence in physics. And he did not have the same way of looking at the elegance of nature that many other physicists, that probably most physicists today do. Most physicists today, if you ask them, probably believe that there is a more elegant theory than the Standard Model. A lot of people believe in string theory, that will eventually be the theory that we settle on, or M theory. But Feynman said that it's not up to us to tell nature that it has to have an elegant theory. It's up to nature to tell us what the theory looks like. And if it's ugly, it's ugly, and we just have to accept it. And I think that's a refreshing and a minority opinion, but I think there's a lot to it.
And is he still at Caltech?
Oh, he died in 86.
Oh, okay. There's a question here. Caltech, available to see and worship. So there's a big fan in the audience for that gentleman.
Oh, well.
So in a lot of the myths... that they had before science even came in, so going back in 10,000 BC, etc., where bad weather was a god having indigestion. And then they started to have these settlements. You talked about, sort of the religious, or maybe just the inward looking. There's more than just hunting and gathering and trying to survive. And you talked a little bit about the, I'll probably pronounce it incorrectly, Göbekli Tepe, as being sort of the first evidence of people saying, I don't need to survive, I can think about other things. Is there any indication of why it's so elaborate? So elaborate. That temple is quite an archaeological wonder. Why is it so elaborate so early?
I don't think anyone knows why it's so elaborate, but the reason that they believe that it is a religious monument was that comparing it to later religious monuments, it was of the similar character, and it had depicted certain animals that were not the kind of animals of everyday life, but the kind of animals that tend to be depicted in later religious rites. But since there was nothing written, obviously, from back then, it's hard to tell in detail exactly why they built it the way they did.
But it stands out as the sort of the quintessential evidence of we now are advanced enough that we can...
Right, yeah, and then the fact that you can see that there were pilgrimages to it, that there was no sign of any settlement nearby or even of water sources. And what you can tell by the remains that are there is that people seem to come from tens of miles to there to do something, which they think was to pray and to make tribute, and then they went back and then they left.
And was there in a lot of the scientific community, in the Islam culture, massive jumps in astronomy and sciences and physics? Was that largely isolated just to that area? Or all of the major scientists that we know about seem to be the Darwins, Newtons, Galileos, etc.? No super prominent Middle Eastern scientists?
There were in the around the year 10-1100, and as the world was emerging from the Dark Ages, where a lot of knowledge was lost, a lot of that came through the Arab states, and they made a lot of progress in things like algebra. The word algebra comes from them, and in optics, and some progress in medicine, and then. What happened was in the Arab world, they started having a lot of infighting, and life got really tough and hard to support scientists. And also the religious fundamentalists took over the centers of learning and demanded that all work really be focused more on morality and moral questions rather than natural science. And it kind of faded as a powerhouse in science. And at the same time, in Europe, they started translating ancient texts, and that things got revitalized. And in Europe, around that time, it was considered like owning a work of art, to own a translation of an ancient Greek text. And so it became a social a nicety or an aesthetic. Object you would have in your home, but that supported a lot of the translation that was done, and eventually it took hold again in Europe.
So if we jump to, we'll jump to some of the, might say, controversies of the day, and you had a very nice example here of autism and its vaccinations and the effect on autism and how that seemingly got out of control. And the climate change is probably one of the massive challenges of our time, and the science seems to be very sound, very broad, and quite a consensus. Yet there's a political movement against it. There are campaigns that it's a hoax. How does science win out over people with these massive megaphones rather than solid?
I don't know if science will win out. There are a lot of people who have a vested interest in not accepting climate change, and I think they're behind a lot of the agitation and the people speaking out against climate change and doubting climate change. And others will never believe science, no matter. I mean, I've seen quotes of people say, "I don't care what science proves, I know better." And so I don't know if science will win out. I mean, it should win out, and I hope it wins out, but human ignorance is very powerful. And so who knows?
And they're a powerful...
Powerful force.
Powerful,
it's a powerful
force, yes.
Human ignorance and, well, it's partially human ignorance, it's partially self-interest of people. Just like the tobacco companies for many years preached that the science that smoking causes cancer was bad science and was wrong. In fact, some of the same people who worked for the tobacco companies are now working for the oil companies. So... yeah, I don't know. For some reason, that doesn't seem to bother people who accept that malarkey. But, you know, then we get what we deserve. But let me say another thing, which is that it'll be what we deserve. And it's not hurting the earth. The earth will be here. The sun will eventually turn into a red giant, probably swallow us up. The sun will explode again. The universe will go on. Yet a lot of species will become extinct prematurely because of us, but the earth will survive. And I think we should realize that what we're hurting are other plants and animals and ourselves.
Because at some point, you would expect, if you go back to the very famous story of Galileo and his observations and the embattlement he had with the church over, you know, whether the heliocentric versus the model that we have now, eventually we have to win over. Eventually it has to come to the scientific reasoning that's indisputable.
Well, Galileo's conflict with the church is an interesting one to talk about. I talk about that in The Upright Thinkers, and it's not what people generally think it was. So most of the church, the hierarchy of the church at the time agreed with Galileo and believed in the Copernican theory. What the conflict was about was whether he had a right to spread that word, which didn't agree with the Bible. And so I think scholars today tend to think that that was more of a battle over who has the right to declare what's true than over what is really true. And after Galileo, it did become accepted that you know, Copernican theory was true, and became, within decades, not much of an issue anymore. But among scientists, new ideas are also could be hard to accept, much less among when they challenge religious issues. But among scientists themselves, new ideas are often difficult to accept. And they're often opposed, new ideas, by other scientists of the time. Not always, like when Einstein came up with relativity about space and time being all entwined and bending each other, which sounds really absurd, it was accepted pretty quickly. On the other hand, when Einstein was one of the inventors of quantum theory, that idea was accepted very slowly and opposed by a lot of people, including eventually Einstein himself. But what's interesting about science is not that whether ideas gain acceptance right away, but as you said, whether or not, and not even whether the general public or the church accepts them, but whether scientists accept them. And history shows that over time, the correct ideas or the more useful ideas win out, and the other ideas and the people who supported them die out.
We don't have centuries for global climate change, but... So a lot of the famous figures that you talked about, we talked about sort of chance encounters, and maybe we'll start with your own chance encounter as an example. You were going to go off and do some study abroad in Germany, and you decided you weren't going to do that, and so you went off to mail the letter of no thank you, I'm going to do something locally, and you bumped into somebody at the mailbox who just casually said to you, you should probably talk to your advisor and not make any rash decisions, and you, I guess, talked to your advisor, and you accepted the position and went on and did your study abroad. And it was, and as you quoted in the book, if you'd taken an extra sip of your coffee or got 2 minutes late, you wouldn't have met that person at the mailbox. You would have mailed your letter of not interested, and you're, who knows what would have happened. That's another path.
Right.
And the same with Darwin. He wasn't first choice to go on the Beagle. And Newton was not even that interested in, you know, orbital mechanics and motion. He was busy with alchemy until Halley came in and said, hey, you know, what would it take for the orbits to be elliptical? And that set him on a motion, a passion to try to understand that. But if they hadn't been prodded a little bit, would these scientific discoveries just been picked up by somebody else, or eventually just these kinds of people come to those conclusions?
I don't think it's just those kinds of people, but whether they would have been eventually invented by someone else, you can't say. In some cases, I would think that they probably would have. In other cases, I would think they might not have. The thing about scientific theories is that there can be many different theories that look very different that describe the same thing. So if Newton hadn't come up with, if Halley hadn't stopped by and prodded Newton into what he did, certainly I would think that society would have been put back, or the advances of science would have been put back by at least by decades, if not more. So we would be living in a much different world today, and that would have changed everything. I mean, maybe we wouldn't even be here, because as you said, just having a cup of coffee could change your life. but someone may have come up with the equivalent of Newton's laws. But it's important to realize that in science, there are different possible theories for the same phenomenon. Take quantum theory as a good example. A guy named Heisenberg, not the Breaking Bad Heisenberg, but the one that Walter named himself after, the real Heisenberg. By the way, I was at Google earlier today, and I scolded them because if you Google the name Heisenberg, you get Breaking Bad for 2 pages before you get Werner Heisenberg from quantum theory. And as a scientist, I take offense at that. But he came up with one version of quantum theory. A guy named Schrödinger came up with another version of quantum theory. And then Richard Feynman, a couple decades later, came up with a third version of quantum theory. These are three completely different ways of looking at quantum theory that use different concepts and different ideas, and it will give you a completely different impression of what quantum theory is. Now, since they describe the same phenomena, it turns out they are mathematically equivalent. So you can have different theories that to humans look completely different and give you a different explanations of what's going on, but have the same results. And if Feynman hadn't lived, well, we just wouldn't have Feynman's quantum theory, I guess, or maybe eventually someone would have come up with it. I don't really know. It's hard to answer that. I believe that if Schrödinger, Heisenberg, and Feynman hadn't lived, someone would have come up with some version of quantum theory and maybe a yet different version. And I think that eventually we learn to explain things, but the specific ways that we explain them as humans might be tied to the people that did them, and the timing can be much delayed if certain fortunate events didn't conspire to have us discover them at that time.
Yeah, it's sort of interesting that you think that in those times there's only a few people. It seems to be a handful, over a dozen people are very prominent early on. But now with the internet and with crowdsourcing and with open source, there must be maybe a million Newtons that just haven't been discovered yet. Like, there must be a flood of knowledge coming in, and I'd say through the internet probably, that everybody has access to so much information, there's opportunity to build on top of what all the other people's works have been. Do you see the scientific community accelerating even faster than anticipated?
Oh, I mean, things are completely different than when I started out. You know, when I had to, when I was working on a problem, excuse me, back in the days when books existed and journals, paper journals, so you'd go to the library, and just explaining what I had to do would take way too long, much less how long it took to actually do it. But if I wanted to find out what was done on a certain problem, I would have to go to different journals, look in the back, the index of each year, and look up different subjects, and they would tell me different papers. I'd have to open different books and look up those papers and go from journal to journal, from year to year, spend weeks and weeks trying to figure out what had been done on a given problem. And now, of course, you just type it into Google Scholar, and there you got it all, you know, and it's all in front of you. And when we published a paper, in those days, the department secretary would make, 400 copies and send them to universities around the world by mail, and they'd eventually get them, and there'd be a certain room where these, quote, preprints would be, and you'd go to the preprint room and see what came in the mail or something. And now you just post it up on a certain website that physicists have, and every day there's new papers there long before they ever get published. They get posted on the website. And so sharing of information is far easier, and you're exposed to a ton more information than ever before, and it's made you more productive because you don't spend all that time getting it, but it's also broadened your vision or your creativity, because now you can see so many different approaches that maybe would have taken far too long to look at all of them in the past.
So do you think with that, are we creating more or less uncertainty in what we think we know?
Well, I don't know what uncertainty in what we think we know. I think that what we know is subject to a lot more scrutiny than it was before, because tons of people can immediately access it, and it's not just sitting there. And also, word of new discovery spreads much faster.
And do you find that we've had all these amazing achievements in science? You know, we all have cell phones and soon we'll have self-driving cars. I'm sure they talked about that at Google. And what about setbacks in science? Could we be farther along than we are today? Either religious setbacks or global confrontation, research financing, obstructionists, Is there anything that we can, there are other aspects to accelerate science? Better education programs, more enthusiasm?
Well, oh, of course, more money would always help. Start right here. We can collect it after this talk. I promise you I'll do better if you cough up a little. Funding is an issue. Problem with science today is similar to the problem in medicine today, which is that the technology of science, the technology you need to further science, is getting more and more complex. So if you look at an elementary particle, what you would call an elementary particle laboratory 100 years ago, it's on a desktop somewhere. And Ernest Rutherford used to do his experiments with odds and ends that he would just pick up for scraps of money. And now the LHC costs billions of dollars to build. And as we progress, we exhaust all those avenues of what's easy, and we get to the place where we have to really build very complex and expensive apparatus to do our experiments. Just as, you know, many years ago, doctors would have x-rays and they'd make their diagnoses, and now we've invented far better things, but they're also far more expensive things. And of course, we all want them because we all want to live forever and have the best care possible. So there's this constant progression of that costs money. So we could accelerate science if we maybe spend a little less on war and a little more on science. That would help.
Just to go back to the Aristotle days, you know, so you mentioned that Aristotle was almost completely wrong on a lot of things that he talked about, but that can't be said of anyone who worked carefully and studied for centuries. Was he still a worthwhile step forward? Did he accelerate science?
Well, that's a very good question. My gut feeling is that no, he did not. He brought Greek science in a way to a kind of pinnacle, but in a false direction. He respected greatly those scientists who came before him, the original physicists like Thales, but I think he took people in the wrong direction. So, at the risk of being now attacked by philosophers, I would say that studying the history of science, that he probably was a more of a detriment than an aid.
So you. That's a sort of an interesting segue into a unique relationship maybe you have with Deepak Chopra. And I encourage everyone to go onto YouTube and look at the one-hour conversation that you have. Very, very interesting. But science seems to be, you can't talk about hard science without religion and theology coming into play. Does that, are they harmonious, or are they driving towards harmony? Or is there just always going to be a wedge between these two philosophical views of views of the earth and the world?
Well, first we should remember that science really arose from spiritual and religious questions. In the beginning when we first settled down, chemistry came from, the first chemists were embalmers who were trying to preserve the human body from rotting. And the early pioneers of science, Robert Boyle in chemistry, and Newton, and Darwin even, were all engaged in science as a way of understanding God. And they thought that by looking at God's work, you'd have a deeper understanding of God. So there certainly doesn't have to be a dichotomy between science and religion. If you take, the problem tends to arise when you take the Bible seriously. And it's interesting that people pick and choose when they take the Bible seriously. So the Bible says that homosexuals should be stoned to death. Very few politicians, Rand Paul doesn't stand up and say that, but other politicians will say that evolution, that creationism is true and evolution is wrong because the Bible says so. The Bible says, this is one that's very impractical, that if a child is disrespectful, you should kill it. How many of us or our children would have survived such a law? Of course, a lot of this is in the Old Testament, but people tend to ignore, though that was also God's word, and people ignore that. But then when the Bible implies that the earth is 6,000 years old, they can't accept that. I don't understand that thinking. And so, I don't know if you're interested in Deepak, but Deepak doesn't believe in the Bible and that the biblical God, but he believes in a kind of universal consciousness that's driving everything, kind of very Aristotelian. Mm. And he also happens to be a great fan of science and a lover of science. He's always trying to prove his ideas using science, and that's where he and I clash.
He strikes me as a very open-minded person, and he's apparently better at physics after the lesson that you gave him.
Well, we met at he was on a Nightline show, and he was debating Michael Shermer of the Skeptic Society that some of you may have heard of, and they were both using physics to bolster their arguments, and they were both accusing the other of not knowing physics. And the moderator, I was sitting on my hands, I was not going to get up and say anything in this. And then the moderator recognized me being a physicist in the audience, and during a questioning, brought me up and put me on the spot and said, ask Deepak a question. And so I asked him, do you want me to teach you physics so that you can use it correctly? And what ensued was a little debate between us that I think you can still find on YouTube that a lot of people talk about. It actually starts with me asking the question. It doesn't show that I was like pulled out and forced to ask the question. But Deepak was very open-minded and friendly guy. And after this, I went up to him and asked him if he wanted to really learn physics. And he said, sure. And we ended up writing a book together where we debate, called War of the Worldviews, where we alternate chapters arguing with each other. And we became friends and we've been arguing ever since.
Well, because I thought the second title to that book was Why We Agree on Everything between you and Deepak.
Yes. In The Upright Thinkers, I said that's why we called it War of the Worldviews and not Why We Agree on Everything.
Yes.
I think something like that.
What just jumped is maybe a little bit of your work you did with Stephen Hawking.
I'm sorry, say again?
A little bit of work that you did with Stephen Hawking. And I was under the same understanding that, black holes are going to vacuum up the universe. But if nothing can escape a black hole, how can a black hole evaporate and eventually disappear?
Well, that was his great discovery, was that some things do escape the black hole, or they go into the black hole and they're re-emitted by the black hole. And that was hard for certain people to accept, but it's pretty well accepted now. So a black hole, the original idea for a black hole is what we would call a classical idea, meaning that it's consistent with Newton's laws, or in this case with Einstein's theory of general relativity, but it's not a quantum idea. It's a non-quantum idea. That's what we call classical. And so the concept of black holes was based on that, and what Stephen did was he analyzed black holes from the quantum point of view, and that's where this effect arose. So we don't have a theory, as I said earlier, that combines gravity with any quantum theory. So he had to kind of use two contradictory theories, knowing how to use a little bit of this and a little bit of that to do his analysis, because we don't have a theory of quantum gravity. But that's what he did, and so it's a quantum effect that causes that.
No, I don't understand any of that, but thank you very much. and working with Stephen in his condition, how is the research done and communicated? Is there new techniques? Is you talking a little bit about the book about how to think differently and approach problems creatively? He must have been quite a miraculous person, adept at attacking things quite differently.
Yeah, I mean, I can't really grasp how he does it. Just the idea alone that he can't use pencil and paper, and he does it all in his head, is really beyond me. I mean, when I was in high school, I was a chess player, and there were people who would play blindfolded, and they played simultaneous games, or they play simultaneous games blindfolded, yeah. And they sometimes would trip, but they did pretty well generally. And he does physics, essentially blindfolded. I don't understand how a mind could do that, but he manages to do that. And I know that he thinks very geometrically and less in equations, but I don't know. I don't know how he does it, but it's amazing. And but our communication was just normal, other than that, he would, in those days, he could only communicate at about maybe 6 words a minute. So it took a lot of patience to sit there. You'd almost meditate. At some point, I was meditating. And then at other points, it was just very, very helpful, because you could see as he was writing out his responses, I could see the partial responses, and I could have a chance to think of my answer as he was doing it, whereas if it was in real time, he would have probably gotten frustrated with me because I was too slow. But now he was the slow one having to type it out, so it all worked out just fine.
Well, we're down to, unfortunately, we're down to the end of our conversation here, so I just have one final question for you. Out of all the research you've done, and in all of your books, not limited to the current Upright Thinkers, if you could have dinner with any historical, maybe scientific, maybe non-scientific person, who would you have at your dinner table, and why?
My first choice would be someone from the future. Is that possible?
Yeah, I'm certain it is.
Oh, if that's possible, it's hard to choose whom because they're probably not born yet. But I would love to jump 100 years forward and know what we do discover in the rest of the century. And that would probably be my first choice.
And do aliens exist? Do aliens exist?
Oh, that's a very interesting question, too. So here is an instance that I use of where I have very I have faith. This is it helps me understand people who believe in the Bible and other things that I don't see evidence for, because I believe that there are aliens, intelligent life forms, and yet no one should be able to tell you that we have any reason to believe that. We have discovered that there are other stars that are like our sun. And there's other planets that live in what's called a habitable zone that would have liquid water and other conditions that might form life. And we know that if we have simple organisms like bacteria, they can evolve into intelligent beings like most of us are. But what we don't know is how the first macromolecules of life came into existence, whether it's RNA or DNA. That's something that we're still working on. And without knowing how that works or what they even were, we don't know what the chances of that happening are given a situation like ours. It could be that if we found another sun that was like our sun and a solar system that evolved like our solar system, that the chances of those first molecules of life forming, the seeds of life, are one in 100 million, in which case there'd be plenty of life throughout the universe. Or they could be one in 100 trillion, in which case we're probably alone. And we don't know the answer. So the scientific answer to that question is we can't say. And yet my gut feeling is, yeah, of course. So there you go. I can understand how people can really feel that something's true without having any evidence for it. But that's the only instance in my life that I can think of.
So we just may not be the only upright thinkers in the universe.
No, we may not be.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.